play a brew, or make day two. You don't have to choose. Cave Dan here for the Faithless Brewing Podcast. Today's episode is a deep dive into Niv-Mizzet Reborn, a Faithless Brewing original and the spiciest deck in Modern that you should be playing. We took this deck to Grand Prix Minneapolis, where Damon cruised to a day two cash finish. Dragons were brought to light, egos were unmoored, and a whole lot of players got gacked. All of that and more is coming up on this edition of Faithless Brewing. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
And welcome to episode 16 of the Faithless Brewing Podcast. I am David Robertson, coming to you live from Minneapolis, joined by Damon Alexander. Damon, are you back in Seattle now?
I am.
And we are joined also, as usual, by Dan Schriever. He's caved in online. Dan, are you also back on the East Coast?
Alas, yes, I am back in Connecticut. It was a great week visiting the Twin Cities. Had a great time playing at the Grand Prix this weekend.
Absolutely.
So yeah, we were briefly all in Minneapolis for some amount of days. I unfortunately did not get to play in the Grand Prix. We had a little snafu with the company I work for, so shout outs to Galway, Ireland and Juncos, Puerto Rico. But you guys held it down. You showed the faith in the heart of the cards. You guys both played multiple tournaments this weekend, right? You played the MCQ and the GP, and Dan, you played the PTQ. Is that correct?
I did.
I'm not accusing anybody of anything. I'm just setting the record straight.
Turns out they're all MCQs these days.
Yeah, well, that's well said. So even though it's a hot girl summer, it is really a Hogak summer, but you guys decided not to play Hogak. You want to talk a little bit about the deck you played and kind of why you picked it and what you thought its sort of pluses and minuses were?
So the deck that we played was Niv-Mizzet Reborn, five-color Bring to Light Niv-Mizzet. Niv to Light, Bring to Niv. It's called different things, Rainbow Niv-Mizzet. This is the deck we've been talking about often on this podcast ever since we sort of first proposed it way back in episode 2, I want to say, right after War of the Spark came out.
Well, Dan, you designed this deck, so I feel like you should get to name it. I don't feel like you should have to be like, oh, people call it different things. What do you want it to be called?
What do I want it to be called? Oh, gosh, you put me on the spot here.
All right, well, you don't have to decide that. Right? You can just go to the deck, but
I mean, it has, if you look it up on MTG Goldfish, it has two different names. It's called something like Rainbow Niv-Mizzet or Five Color Niv or something like that. Yeah, their algorithm sorts it differently. Anyway, the point is, it's the deck that we talk about often. It's probably our most successful, winningest brew in the sense that it now has its own sort of active community. There's a Niv-Mizzet Discord channel where there's a lot of people working on this deck sort of all the time. There are streamers playing it. In the Modern Streamers League, there is Davius Minimus is representing Niv-Mizzet. There's the streamer Squatreef or ZX Rogue on Magic Online putting up a lot of finishes. It's becoming more of a known deck, although it's still not totally getting the respect that I think it will get in the future, because I think it's actually quite good. So that's what we both played. Why did we play it? Well, I'll put that question to Damon. Why did we play this deck?
Well, I wasn't really feeling Kiora's Dragons was up to the task of facing down Hogak along with the rest of Modern. I didn't really want to play Blue-White. I didn't really want to play Blue-Red Phoenix. That deck seems like it's kind of on a downswing. And those are the decks that I had built. And so then I considered playing the Hogak deck that you have, just because if you can't beat him, join him. But then it seems like, oh yeah, we could just play the same deck. I've never actually done that, where you go to a tournament and play the same 75 cards as your friend. And I have to say that after doing that, it was a blast. I'm glad we did that.
That was probably the most interesting experience, I think, for me, was trying to arrive at a consensus, even though it was only a two-person consensus.
So you guys did play the exact 75. There's not a card different. There's not one extra card in someone's sideboard or main deck or anything? Or
no, it turns out that if you go to a GP and you expect to find every random uncommon, you actually just can't do it. And so we only had one copy of Crumble to Dust between us. Dan brought a lot of cards. I brought some cards, but I didn't bring that card. I brought an Alpine Moon. And so that was the one difference.
Right. 74 of the 75 were the same. Damon's list.
Well, he wanted one more rare, so that's all right.
Yeah, exactly.
for anyone who is tuning in and has not followed our podcast from the beginning, they may not be entirely familiar with this deck. Damon, I'm going to ask you to give a brief summary of the deck since you had to do so on camera for the coverage. You got a little deck tech spotlight.
Yeah, great little one-minute deck tech on the Channel Fireball Twitter page. Obviously, coverage isn't what we would like it to be, but it was still kind of cool to see Damon break it down after he had quite a good start to the tournament.
Yeah, so this deck is built around Niv-Mizzet Reborn. He is Wooburg casting cost, white, blue, black, red, green, for a 6/6 legendary dragon avatar with flying. So he's quite beefy on his own. And ETB, you get to reveal the top 10, not just 8, not just 9, but 10 cards of your library. And for each color pair or guild, you choose a card that's from that guild and you put in your hand. The rest go on the bottom. And so the objective of the deck is to basically play kind of a 5-color control role for the first few turns, get to 5 mana, slam your Niv-Mizzet, and then have your hand get populated with maybe like a Teferi, a Renin 6, an Abrupt Decay, an Izzet Charm, a Lightning Helix, who knows what else, maybe they're like a Bring to Light. And then if they kill the Niv, you have another Bring to Light, and then Bring to Light lets you go find another Niv and cast it with basically no increase in cost. It's a perfectly reasonable, you pay 5 for the Bring to Light or you pay 5 for the Niv, same cost. Or alternatively, we can use the Bring to Light to find any number of other cards in the deck as needed, although usually Niv is the best one because it'll just draw you into anything else you would want. There were times where I cast Bring to Light for a Tolsimir, Friend to Wolves, if you need a life gain. I've cast it for a Kai's Guile at instant speed with a Teferi on the board when my dredge opponent dredged their last 4 cards, leaving them with no library and no graveyard. I've cast it to get a K command in my opponent's draw step with a Teferi to make them discard the Karn Liberator they just drew. And so you get this flexible package here. And then the deck features this kind of wonky 5-color mana base built around Pillar of the Perrins, which taps for any mana, but only to be used for multicolored spells. And then we have a snow mana base in Arkham's Astrolabe, which lets us A, survive a Blood Moon, and B, be able to tap for all colors. Then we round it out with some Birds of Paradise, which helps smooth things out also. And then the sideboard is approximately 10 anti-Hogak cards, and then 5... other cards.
So the way the main deck is constructed, on average, what is the number of hits you expect from a typical Niv-Mizzet? Your first Niv-Mizzet on turn 4 or 5, I mean, do you have a statistical?
Exactly 4. No more, no less. 4 hits off Niv-Mizzet.
All right.
There's a Frank Karsten calculator script that someone has put together, but I think just from experience, 4 is what I expect to get off Niv-Mizzet. My personal best on the weekend was 7, and my worst was 1.
Yeah, I think I was in a similar range where I think 3 to 5 is really pretty common. Post sideboard, things get a lot worse because you put in these like ley lines and surgicals and paths, and those don't work. And so I think at one point post side, I've hit as low as 2.
It's a common experience to resolve a Niv. You flip your top 10, you collect the cards, and then you go to cleanup step and have to discard 3 cards or something.
Yeah, it's kind of disgusting. It's amazing. It's just like flipping over 10 cards is like a show. Niv makes you put on a little bit of a show every time you cast him.
So as you guys were sort of considering this deck, obviously it's fun to cast dragons. It's fun to draw a bunch of cards. What were the kind of things you were trying to learn when you were doing your testing? Or what were the decks you were thinking you might be playing against? And how were you trying to sort of attack each of those decks?
I would say the first thing we're trying to figure out is actually, honestly, I don't think Dan or I have played with the card Leyline of the Void a whole lot. I think we both basically bought our copies for this tournament. And so we wanted a little bit of practice just when you bring it in. Like, does it come in every graveyard matchup? Do we even like it at all? I think we actually came to an interesting conclusion on that we don't like it that much. But we started off basically playing against Izzet Phoenix, Hogak, Blue-White, and Red Prowess, just because those were the decks we had on hand. We just wanted to get a sense for how the game's played out, what the key sideboard cards are, and then just get a few more reps in with Niv-Mizzet, or in my case, Hogak, to see if I fell in love in the last minute. I did not.
Yeah, those 4 matchups that you mentioned, it's not just that those were the decks that we had. There were other matchups that we expected to be common in the metagame where I felt like we didn't need to test, really, because we could sort of just imagine how the games play out. Like, against most of the field, Niv-Mizzet plays out the same way. You just try to trade your cards for their cards, 1 for 1, and then eventually you resolve Niv and just reload your hand, and then you win. And that applies to basically any creature-based matchup, like whether that's humans or Jund or Infect or anything else, Merfolk. there are some sort of specialty matchups where you need a different card, like against Tron, the matchup comes down to will you resolve an Unmoored Ego or a Crumble to Dust or something like that. Or maybe there's some random combo deck where, you know, you need to have some specific hate piece or something. Those decks, like, I felt like we didn't need to test them per se. But the Hogek deck, the blue-white matchup, and these red decks, those are ones that I felt like the outcome is somewhat in doubt based on our builds and our starting hands and how we choose a sideboard. And I think these are were also going to be common matchups. So I think I felt good about sort of focusing on those on our sort of Thursday dedicated testing day.
Do you think it's fair to say that those are the matchups where you're sort of bring to light for a silver bullet, if you will, is too slow? And so those are the matchups where sort of the actual cards in your hand have to win the game, not the one piece that you're tutoring for, or the, as you say, sort of removal spell, Niv-Mizzet, draw four removal spells plan.
Dan and I actually had a slightly different take on some of these things, where the classic example is if post-sideboard you have a seven-card hand that's like a solid hand for the deck but doesn't feature any of your sideboard cards, do you keep it? And to me, it feels like sometimes what you can do is this deck plays a bunch of very flexible cards that can answer a lot of situations. And so as long as you can stabilize until you play a Niv in some sense, as long as you haven't fallen too far behind, hopefully that Niv will draw you into what you need coming from your sideboard. Hogek is a little tricky. They come out of the gates really fast. But with 10 pieces of sideboard hate, you're bound to have a few cards going on.
Yeah, and the question, the way you put it, Dave, is really interesting. It's something that I was specifically trying to learn from our testing as well. I was thinking of it mainly as a question for the red decks. Burn and Red Prowess or Red Phoenix play slightly differently, where I would say that the Burn matchup should be analyzed in the way you described, where you compare your starting sevens, you know, ignore the fact that you have this Niv-Mizzet engine, compare your starting sevens, do you have a Lightning Helix and a second life gain spell? If you do, you can probably just win with just trading cards, because like they can't handle like so many life gain cards, and just because gold cards tend to have life gain tacked on, you can build your 75 such that you have a lot of incidental life gain post board against like regular burn. But the Prowess deck is different because it keeps reloading, whether that's with Faithless Looting or Phoenix's Recurring from the graveyard or with Bedlam Revelers. In that matchup, I kind of felt like you do need to actually resolve a Niv. So like against like standard red-white burn, I think you can side down on Niv as kind of a bad card in that matchup. The game is decided early turns, whereas Red Prowess just keeps coming at you, and you actually do need to kill them before they keep reloading. And there I actually was feeling like we shouldn't sideboard out any of the Niv-Mizzets or the Bring to Lights. Is it Phoenix kind of fell in this in-between space where it is possible to destroy all of their threats because they don't play that many of them? They add more post-sideboard, but they still don't have that many individual threats in the 75, and you can theoretically just kill them all. So the Phoenix spectrum was very interesting to sort of parse out. How do we need to win these matchups? Do we need the Niv-Mizzet cascading card engine or not? And then blue-white is his own sort of set of problems in that question.
Okay, so you guys felt like, all right, if we could just play Jund and Humans all day long, this Niv-Mizzet is a great deck, right? So after playing those four matchups, what was your sense? Was it like, these are weak matchups, or maybe the other ones except for Hogek are manageable if we sideboard a certain way or build our main deck a certain way? Or what was your takeaway?
I think we came out of the testing session feeling, I mean, we basically were trying the hardest decks against us. And that was, you have to take that, you know, understanding that you're not going to face just those decks all weekend. And every matchup felt totally winnable. I would say that Hogek felt like no matter what we did, we couldn't really get the matchup anywhere probably above maybe 40%, maybe even less. Although I guess our numbers over the weekend were kind of in that range.
Mine were not. I went 1-4 against Hogek, 1-3 against the Jund Hogek, plus an additional loss against the Dredge Hogek. You had slightly better results, I think.
I think I went 1-0 against regular Hogek and 2-0 against Dredge Hogek. So I think if we average ours together, actually, it's in that range. And then, yeah, the is it Phoenix, blue-white, and red Phoenix type of decks, we felt like we came out of testing feeling like they were at least 50% and probably better. Things are sometimes rough pre-board, but then post-board things get so much cleaner. Dan, is that how you felt?
Yeah, definitely. For Is It Phoenix, I felt like the post-board games were significantly favored, maybe 60-40, but the pre-board games could be slightly unfavored depending on who won the die roll. The red decks depended a lot on Lightning Helix. it's always a lot harder on the draw in these close matchups. Hogek was such a problem because you almost auto lose game one. And so then, you know, you need a good hand to win game two, and then you need to do that again in game three on the draw. And it's just really tough. Blue-white was probably the most vexing matchup because it kind of felt like it should be winnable if we just had maybe like three more sideboard slots. We could just have slightly more versatile cards against it. If we didn't have to have 10 cards against Hogek, we could make the blue-white matchup good. But that matchup, when we played it, it was such a slugfest that sometimes we'd resolve Niv once, even twice in a game, and then they just keep fighting through it. Like, they just kill all of our threats, and we kill all their threats. And it was, like, still in doubt, 40 cards deep in each deck, who was going to win. Just because the Niv deck doesn't actually play that many cards that win the game. If they happen to surgical your Nivs, because they play min deck surgicals, then you're in a lot of trouble.
And their Planeswalker suite is just so powerful. We play our own Teferis, and they're quite good, but they also have these Narsets and Jaces.
Yeah, so I left testing feeling like I could fix the 75 to improve my matchups drastically against any Phoenix build, whether that's Izzet or Red, and against Blue-White. But I couldn't quite do that and also have a decent Hogek matchup.
And so I think I heard you say, Damon, that you were playing approximately 10 pieces of Graveyard Hate or Hogek Hate. Obviously, Graveyard Hate has some extra bonus because it does affect, you know, some of the Red Prowess builds, Izzet, Phoenix, etc. You guys were playing four Leyline plus other Graveyard Hate cards?
Yeah.
And we'll post their deck lists on the link for the podcast for everybody.
Yeah, so against Hogek, we changed this mid-weekend. But to start with, we brought in two Path, one Surgical, one Lavinia, Azorius Renegade. Basically, she shuts off Hogek and Conflagrate and Force of Vigor. In an Offensa, and then four Leyline of the Void and a Supreme Verdict.
Right, so only maybe half of those cards are graveyard-only hate. But the rest, the other five, are useful cards for the type of threats that they present you with in the course of the game. Creature removal or weird stuff like Lavinia or Anafenza.
Yeah, and then Anafenza was actually kind of an all-star. Dan wound up putting her in his main deck for the Sunday MCQ, and it sounded like she was quite valuable, where he stole a game off Austin Collins, an SCG grinder, and multiple top eight finisher. What happened, Dan? You had to turn one Birds into turn two Call?
I did. My only win against Hogek on the weekend was against Austin Collins. I improved to 2-0 lifetime against Austin Collins, the SCG end boss. But no, he's a great guy. He's an amazing young player.
It was really interesting watching him play Hogek. I managed to watch most of that match, and he pulled off some tricks where, like, I didn't even know those lines were like a thing you do on Hogek. Like, Dan pathed a creature, and this makes perfect sense in hindsight, but he was like, in response, sack my two Bloodguests, and then I will happily fetch a land off your path, and then the Bloodguests come back. And it's like, oh, wow, plus two counters, like, no problem.
Yeah, I was pathing a Hogek and fully expected him to sack it to Carrion Feeder, but instead he decided it was more valuable to use the land drop off the path to, like, get Bloodguest counters bigger, because he had a second Hogek that I didn't know about. Anyway, so that's flashing forward to Sunday, but basically I had moved Anafenza to the main because I was so sick of auto-losing game one, and I was able to win that game because I won the die roll and had Illidan's Call for Anafenza in my opening hand. It was interesting, because I led Snow Forest into Birds of Paradise. On the play, I think he correctly assumed I was on some kind of Ponza variant, so he Fatal Pushed the bird on his turn one, which gave me the time I needed to execute that tutor line. If he had not done that, if he just, like, deployed his threats, Anafenza would have still been too slow on turn three. But the threat of, like, a Blood Moon locking out his mana base bought me a little bit of time, took out his Fatal Push. So, like, that kind of, like, very narrow things lining up exactly right is what is required to, like, steal a game from Hogek pre-sideboard.
So did you feel like Birds of Paradise were kind of necessary to, like, allow you to get out, like, sort of tempo-wise, enough of your cards in the early game against decks like Hogek and maybe some of the Phoenix builds? Or did you feel like the mana creatures were, like, vulnerable to a lot of the sort of burn spells that they were playing?
That's a great segue to sort of the second biggest discussion we spent the most time on the Thursday before the weekend started, which was, like, what exactly are we doing with the mana base? Believe it or not, we started with two Birds of Paradise in our Friday deck list and upped that to three on Saturday. It sounds a little bit crazy saying that out loud, because surely that's like a four of card if you're going to play Birds at all. Damon, do you want to sort of go into our thought process on sort of the mana base options and why we only ended up on three Birds?
Yeah, so it turns out that this deck takes advantage of a lot of different cards that help you get to like the 5-color casting cost of Niv, but each little card that you use that helps you there has its own constraint on it. So, for example, one of them is Arkham's Astrolabe. Great card, helps you get 5 colors, but it requires snow basics. Pillar of the Perrins, great card, but it does not cast Arkham's Astrolabe. It does not cast Birds of Paradise. Birds of Paradise, great card, but not castable off Pillar of the Perrins and not a Niv hit. Same with Astrolabe. And so somehow it felt like 4 birds versus 3 birds and 1 Safe Right quest, that lone Safe Right quest actually felt pretty good to have in there. 4 birds just sort of hits this tipping point where it's no longer worth it. It's a little bit too likely to have these awkward hands. Safe Right quest is castable off almost anything and will help fix you further, whereas Birds requires a smaller subset of cards that can cast it. And then just simply being a Niv hit is honestly big. Just having Niv find you a Safe Right quest versus have a Birds go to the bottom of your deck, I'd much rather have the Safe Right quest. It can then help me hit my 6th land, for example.
Yeah, and the final constraint, the card you didn't mention yet, was Renin 6, this 2-mana Planeswalker, whose best mode is the +1 return a land from your graveyard to your hand. Wonderful effect if you're trying to just make a land drop every turn, but that only works if you have fetch lands. So you end up needing Snow Basic for the Astrolabe, Green Sources for the Birds of Paradise, Fetch Lands for the Renin 6, and then you also would like to play Pillar of the Perrins because from turn 2 onward it's like the best land by far. It's just kind of awkward because it doesn't cast anything on turn 1 and doesn't help the Renin 6 with the Fetch Lands you need. Those were the 4 that we kind of zeroed in on as the... I guess I should say those were the 3, the Astrolabe, the Renin 6, and the Birds of Paradise. We wanted to feature those. And the Safe Right quest was mostly there to round out the numbers, because it's very easy to cast and like fixes all your numbers. It provides everything you're missing. It's castable off pillar, provides a basic land for an Astrolabe if you need that. It can fix for any color, as long as you have white or green aligned dual lands. And like Damon is saying, it allows your Niv to actually find you a land drop, which is often the only thing that Renin 6 does if you hit it off Niv later in the game.
So what were your final numbers there? How many Arkham's Astrolabe did you play? 4?
Yep, all 4. 4 Astrolabes, 4 Pillar. Those felt like they both have problems with being a 4 of, but they are so powerful that the problems are just worth it. It's just worth paying that cost. You'll absolutely have a mulligan because you have a Temple Guard and an Astrolabe, or take a mulligan because you have a Pillar and a Birds, and that's just the price you pay. These cards are both incredibly important when it comes to hitting your 5-color mana. And not only that, just basically... the basics are frequently the worst lands in the deck. If you just have them, you can almost never double spell on turn 4. It's almost impossible to have whatever combination of colors you need. And so having some sort of 5-color fixing every game is very important to having this deck operate smoothly.
So what is the problem with Astrolabe? I thought we liked that as the best one. I didn't realize there was a problem with Astrolabe.
Oh, there's no problem with it. I think it is the best one. There is one problem. How many times did you hit an Astrolabe off Niv?
Many times. It went to the bottom of the deck.
I hit 3 Astrolabes off Niv once.
That's true. So yeah, it does eat up space in the deck. That's a real cost as well.
Our deck at this point, I think, has approximately 30 Niv hits. Maybe even fewer, because Niv himself is not a hit. So 27 Niv hits.
No, fewer than that. I think we were playing 26 on Friday because of the Astrolabe.
Well, we cut a land by Saturday, I think, is the difference.
Gotcha.
So you played 4 Astrolabe, 4 Pillar, and then 3 Bird of Paradise, 1 Safe Right quest, and then how many Renin 6 did you play?
3.
And then how many land did you play total?
23 by Saturday. And that felt like, I think, the right number.
We started with 24 on Friday. The extra land, we wanted a utility land in that slot, something that functioned as a spell, and that, you know, if you were in a situation where you could rebuy that every turn with Renin 6, you're getting more than just a land drop. So the options that we were considering there, this is kind of an ongoing debate on the Mid-Mizzet Discord, by the way. Ghost Quarter was something that people had proposed, because that's an early Tron interaction piece, and you can also, in theory, just take some deck totally off of basics, like a Death Shadow or whatever. There are decks that don't play that many basics. Field of Ruin is one that, you know, when you're playing it, you're still advancing your mana base. That's the one that we tried on Friday. And then the third option is Tranquil Thicket, the green cycling land. If you're recurring that with Renin 6, it doesn't cost you a land drop to convert that +1 off Ren into a new card. Whereas something like a Canopy Land, a Horizon Canopy, or a Nurturing Peatland would be good, but you have to like use up your land drop to recur it, which is not as good. Because you do want to like keep hitting lands.
So by the time the sort of main event on Saturday came around, you guys had decided, there's pluses to some of these cards, but none of the utility lands really made your final cut.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is you need to keep a lot of fetches for Ren and Six. You need to keep a lot of the pillars because they're the best land. You need to keep four shocks at least, and going below six basics felt maybe wrong. I think that we could maybe serve five basics, but this just adds up to being right around 23 lands. It's like your minimum number. And so if you want to add one of these utility lands, you either have to cut a spell or make some serious sacrifice in your mana base that we didn't feel comfortable with.
Yeah, many people think you should cut Pillar of the Perrins, either cut it entirely or trim to three copies, two copies, because while it is such a great land from turn two onwards, it doesn't actually help you with your counts, like those constraints that we talked about. It's more like the luxury land. I think it's actually more important than that. I think it's a crucial land to make the deck smooth and good and pain-free. So I think it's a privilege to get to play this land. It's not like an extra bonus or something.
You're saying you get to play this land. You don't have to play this land.
I think that sounds right. Whichever version results in us playing four locked. That's what I'm trying to advocate for. If we trick ourselves into playing fewer than four pillars, we're maybe doing something wrong. And I think after the weekend, I kind of felt like maybe Ren and Six was the problem. I know that's sort of heresy to say that. Ren requiring so many fetch lands, it wasn't totally worth it, I thought.
Yeah, I felt similar about Ren and Six. There were certain times where Ren and Six was, you know, I'm on the play and I get to do a turn two Ren and Six, punk your Noble Hierarch, and it was amazing then. But there were a lot of times where it didn't quite fit in with the deck's plan, besides the fact that it helps you ramp to Niv quite effortlessly, which actually is very good. But the downtick mode is just not that good right now. It's not good against the Red Prowess decks. It's not good against Hogak. And so I guess what's interesting is, if you only play one Ren and Six, you still kind of want to have all the fetches to make it live. I mean, could you start cutting fetches at that point? Do you even want to cut fetches?
Right, exactly. Yeah, I don't know. So I played, I think, 25 matches of Sanctioned Magic this week. I played Infect once, where I Ren and Six got to ping a bunch of stuff, and beyond that, it never pinged anything. It was just there for getting lands. And since we didn't have a Tranquil Thicket, we were often flooding out. I don't think I ever ultimated Ren and Six. Did you ever do that, Damon? I don't think you did either.
I think I did once, but that was it.
Yeah, so I mean, hitting your land drops is great. It's a very efficient card, but I don't want to oversell this as somehow Ren and Six fixing all the deck's problems. It's just a tool. It's a useful tool, but I don't think it's like you must immediately add three Ren and Six to your deck. I actually cut down to two for my Sunday tournament list.
Yeah, I feel like one Ren and Six may even be like a reasonable number. That way it's like this Niv hit where if you hit that and a Huntmaster, you can ask, well, Niv, the Ren and Six might help me hit a land drop next turn. And so in that sense, it's a two mana card that if you're light on lands at that point is kind of a one mana card that will then provide you value from then on. But I can see zero being the right number. I can see two being the right number. It's still unclear to me.
I'm saying this with the knowledge that the people in the Discord will vigorously disagree with what we're saying right now. They think, many of them think that Ren and Six is a four of staple in the deck, and you should play as many copies as you can get your hands on. I'm not there yet, personally. When you talked about this deck 2 weeks ago, I talked about how I played it at a local 1K, and the deck felt great. You know, I crushed the Swiss, I went undefeated. I only had one Ren and Six, and it was like fine when I drew it. It was pretty good, but it wasn't essential to the deck's functioning.
I will say my anecdotal experiences, I have literally never lost to Niv-Mizzet when I've played it, unless they play a Ren and Six. But obviously you guys have a lot more actual testing data than I do.
What deck were you playing and what did the Ren and Six do in that matchup?
Well, just a bunch of different matchups, but it was another angle. They ended up ultimated multiple times against me as they were sort of trading all these resources. So after I was able to deal with the Niv-Mizzet issue.
Interesting.
Were you playing a bunch of decks with green-white small creatures?
Certainly that was a couple of matchups, I'm sure. I'd have to look at each match that I played, but I mean, I have played Niv-Mizzet, you know, over the course of the 16 weeks we've done this, you know, 7 or 8 times. I've literally never lost a game unless they resolve Ren and Six. So that's kind of my, like, it's interesting to hear you guys say that, I guess. Like I said, I've not done any testing. This is just from the other side playing a bunch of random decks that we've brewed up. So
you've ran into it that many times? That's crazy.
Yeah. It's been, especially recently, I think maybe the success, like Dan was describing, the Saffron Olive's played it a couple times, a few other, you know, prominent streamers have tried it out, and yeah, maybe it's gained some ground.
Yeah, it's funny, the MCQ on Friday in the last round, I was playing with this guy, I think his name was Sam, And we ID'd just because it was a great EV with the way the prize structure works, and we played it out for fun. And he's started talking about how he likes the Niv matchup against his deck scales. And I was like, this guy knows the Niv. What's going on here? I don't know how this matchup is for us. And he knows it. And so he's like, yeah, I played against Niv-Mizzet earlier today. And I was like, wait, you played against Dan? He's like, no, Dan, no, who's that? And I was like, what? So apparently we had another Niv-Mizzet player, a couple hundred person MCQ, who's making Niv over 1% of the meta.
The other question I had, Dan, speaking of that 1K, I think there you played Search for Tomorrow instead of mana creatures. Is that correct?
I did. So that gets into that Birds of Paradise question, because I played 3 Search for Tomorrow, and those sort of became 3 Birds of Paradise. I was really torn about that. Search has both constraints and benefits, the biggest one being that it gets you a land and they can't take your land away, right? Like you have this precious Bird of Paradise and these mean, nasty red mages can just take it away from you with a Lava Dart or a Fatal Push or whatever it is.
Or a Ren and Six.
I mean, that would be disastrous if someone killed your Birds of Paradise with a Ren and Six. So one of the arguments in favor of birds is that, like, if they kill your bird, that's okay. Like, those are pretty good matchups anyway. And at least they didn't come out the gates on you or something. But it's also like, you know, if you really are planning on birds as a mana source, you just don't want them to be able to attack your lands by picking off of birds. So I was not really sure whether I liked the birds there. Search is slow. It doesn't allow your most explosive starts of like bird into Teferi or something like that. And also Search requires you to play even more basic lands so you don't run out. But it's reliable. It's like a reliable card. Damon, do you remember sort of what was our final decision on why we should trust the birds?
Yeah, we had this moment of where we were thinking through the following. Double spelling with, for example, like Assassin's Trophy, Lightning Helix is very difficult on turn 4. And one of the only ways to do that is with a 5-color source. You can't easily do that with only basics. You have to have exactly those 4 basics. And so there's a couple of things you can do. One is try to have a lot of 5-color sources. And 2 is actually maybe instead of playing a bunch of 2 CMC spells, play some cards that have higher CMCs, which generally are more powerful. Instead of having to double spell on turn 4, we could actually just play like one more powerful spell. So for example, like Huntmaster. This is kind of important because this deck actually can't play many 1-drops because every 1-drop you play is very hard to be a Niv hit. It has to be like these lucky, weird hybrid mana cost cards like Safe Right Quest. And so because of this constraint to have most of your action spells be at least 2 mana, it turns out if they're all exactly 2 mana, they just have tons of pips in them. And so trying to cast 4 colored pips on turn 4 is hard. And so birds will not only help you do that, it will also help you ramp from 1 to 3 if you put in cards with like a Kaya or a Teferi with 3 CMC and 2 pips required. And so you get this 1-3 skip that Rhett talked about last week.
Yeah, so I think maybe our final decision was that even though birds is fragile, there are some matchups where the only thing that matters is how quickly you can get your relevant piece onto the board. Like whether that's turn 2 Kaya, turn 2 Anafenza, turn 2 Teferi or something, or turn 2 Onward Ego, which can be the difference against Tron. Like if they are on the play, a turn 3 Onward Ego is not fast enough. If you have a bird, you can actually get the ego out ahead of them, which Search for Tomorrow cannot do. And the vulnerabilities of bird, I found that we could get around it just by siding it out. I in the end, think we should side it out against blue-white because we end up with too many mana sources. I think we should side it out against the red decks because they'll just pick it off. There are matchups where you actually want to reduce the number of mana sources in your deck. So 3 birds is kind of a compromise way to do that. They actually get sided out a fair bit, despite being such an important source. They're wonderful when they live.
Okay, so you guys made, you know, it sounds like a bunch of interesting decisions, and some of them, you know, maybe are still slightly open questions, depending on sort of the metagame you expect to face. And then Friday, you both went to the MCQ. How did it go?
Well, my tournament started off with a little rocky start. I lost round 1 to a blue-black fairies deck. Anytime you lose to fairies in a comp REL setting, you kind of feel like you did something wrong. Like, it doesn't feel great. Like, he beat me fair and square. I won game 2, but he just picked apart my hand and landed a Bitter Blossom the other 2 games. I flooded out a little bit. He did what his deck was trying to do. I was like, man, have I drastically overestimated the power of Niv-Mizzet? Because that's not a tier deck that I just lost to. But I was able to bounce back. I won the next 3 rounds in a row. I beat, Phoenix? I beat a Red Prison deck that turn 1 Blood Moon me. I didn't win that game, but I won the next 2. And that was kind of a theme throughout the weekend, is that a lot of people were expecting their blood moons to really do a number on me, and they were just were not effective. Like, we had so many basics and astrolabes that just kind of ignored blood moon throughout the weekend, which felt amazing. And I think I'd be a blue-white deck as well. That also always feels good. So I was up 3-1 with two rounds to play. The way these MCQs are structured at the GP weekend, you're kind of eliminated from top 8 after one loss. So you're basically just playing for prize sticks at that point. And so, yeah, I was hoping to win my last two, but I ran into Hogak Dredge and regular Hogak in the last two rounds and was not able to win those games. So I finished 3-3 on Friday. Damon, you had a little bit better results.
Slightly. I lost to Red Green Ponza in the first round in three games. Game three, I just didn't find a Niv in time. I think that a Niv would have given me enough ammo to fight past. Their hand was just all gas. It was just like a bunch of dragons and Inferno Titans and Chandras, and I just fell behind at some point. Then I played Hogak and barely scraped it out in three. A lot of stuff had to go right to win that third game. Then I played against Grixis Urza. We had a really interesting match, and the main deck Unmoored Ego came in huge, picking off the Thopter Foundries. It let me win an almost unwinnable game. Then I lost a blue-white control, which always feels bad. I just, in games two and three, I flooded out massively. I had like 18 lands out of the deck. So I had like four lands and like 20 spells left. And I was like, I think I just got unlucky, but maybe I did something wrong. One of those feelings.
And this is after you resolved Nimizzard.
Yeah. That was sad. And then I beat Burn 2-0, which felt nice. I won the die roll, and I just had like some insane Lightning Helix, Tulsa Mirrors, whatever, start game one. And then game two, I just cast a million life gain spells, which gave me a nice break to get some lunch. Thanks, Burn players. No matter which way it goes, it'll be over fast. And then the last round, we played out for fun against Hardened Scales, and his draws were pretty slow, and I was able to stabilize and win fairly easily. So kind of 3-2-1 or 4-2, depending on how you count those results. I feel like I could have, like, I felt every match was winnable.
I want to maybe just say a little bit more about the Dredge and Hogak matchups that I played. They were a little discouraging, and they boded ill for my future matchups against Dredge and Hogak on Saturday and Sunday. So what happened against Dredge in round 5 was that I happened to win game 1, which is fairly rare, but I was able to land a timely Kaya's Guile. So I was feeling pretty good because I had all these sideboard cards, you know, up a game and I have 10 cards or whatever that I'm bringing in. But then it's this inexperience with Leyline where I kind of felt like if I'm bringing in all four Leylines, I shouldn't keep a medium hand that doesn't have a Leyline. And I just wasn't able to find a good hand with Leyline, so I ended up both games 2 and 3 mulliganing to 5, finding the Leyline on 5 cards, and just immediately got Nature's Claimed both games, and then my resulting hand was just non-functional. And that was kind of a bummer, and I was wondering, like, what happened here? Like, if I had just had other graveyard hate that didn't, like, have to be exactly in my opening hand, or that didn't just die to a claim for no value, maybe I would have been in those games more. Like, Damon, you and I discussed my game 3 hand. My initial 7 did not have any graveyard hate, but it was, like, not a bad hand. It had a Birds, a Thought Erasure, and, like, a Huntmaster or something, and maybe something else. And I was not sure if I should keep that or not. I ended up mulling to 5, and like I was saying, you know, I found one ley line, but then just did nothing else throughout the game and died. At round 6 against Hogak, I lost the die roll, and my opponent mulled to 4 and easily dispatched me on like turn 3 or something like that. It was like, it was not even close. This was against Andrew Walbers, who is somewhat well known for his results with Ponza. He won a Star City Games Open last year and then had a GP Top 8 the next week. He actually beat me again on the Sunday MCQ and went on to win that MCQ with Hoyak again. So he had a great weekend. I think he went something like, he was 75% with that deck on the weekend. So shout outs to him. He's a nice guy. And he was probably wondering, like, why, when he saw me on Sunday, why I was still registering the same deck when I had done nothing whatsoever in our Friday match, and once again did nothing in our Sunday match. I just didn't even punch back at all. I was like trying to find ley lines or not, and I just couldn't do it. So I was having a terrible time against these graveyard decks, and it sort of made me wonder, like, what am I looking for in my opening hand exactly, and how much has to go right? Because I didn't feel like I was making any progress with like this mulliganing to ley line strategy, or maybe I just got unlucky. I'm not sure. So Dave, I mean, what's your sense of like, What do you do when you're bringing all these graveyard hate pieces and you don't have one in your opening 7?
I don't know, man. I've tried not to be like too salty about it on this pod, but It has felt like a little hopeless. Like, even if you play main deck graveyard hate, I've been experimenting with a bunch of different decks that can play graveyard main deck hate. You don't know what your opponent's playing. So like Damon says, you've got a real nice keepable seven without graveyard hate. You don't know if you're playing Hogak or not. I don't want to mulligan. So you keep your seven and they, you know, turn three kill you. And you're like, well, I mean, graveyard hate is great if you have it. And yeah, after Boar, they bring in, I know that the even the final of the GP, it was interesting. The gentleman who won, I forget his name, he said he didn't even bring in any of his hate because he knew that his opponent would bring in both graveyard hate and enchantment removal. And all he was going to bring in was sort of the disenchant effects to free up his graveyard. So he would be much more sort of graveyard dense. So when you get into that cat and mouse game where one player has a proactive plan that if no one draws anything, they're just going to win, you're in a really tough spot. So yeah, I've done both. I've mulliganed and mulliganed to graveyard hate plus like vaguely playable hand and I've lost. I've kept my quote unquote like reasonable hand without graveyard hate and lost. I think there's a reason that Hogak is winning all these matches, and it's because maybe there isn't an easy answer, especially for a deck like this that can't easily block or interact with just the 2/1 recurrable cards or the, you know, 4/3 recurrable cards. You don't have,
or the 8/8 trample recurrable cards.
You know, at least you could imagine pathing that or something, but just the basic strategy that they're playing is very good against the Niv-Mizzet plan of like cast removal spell on your 2-drop with our 2-mana removal spell, because those cards are all coming back.
Yeah, absolutely.
You can say you can path the Hogak, but you remember that like they got the Hogak off of like a Satyr Wayfinder trigger. They don't even like, go down a card. Like, you go down a card. You go down 2 cards on that.
If they had a Kyrian Feeder, you're kind of nowhere on that interaction.
Yeah, I'm not saying that you can beat this deck. I'm just saying that even against their like weaker draws, they don't have Hogak. I don't think Niv-Mizzet is well positioned against just a bunch of 2/1 vampires and 2/1 zombies they can cast for a black.
I mean, what it comes down to is that, yeah, this deck, like Hogak is actually just overpowered. Everybody understands it. And then when you go to this match, you're like, I think I can beat it. I see all these sideboard cards. And it actually turns out you kind of can't. You can make the matchup maybe 40%, maybe. But that deck is just insane. It has a 55% win rate en masse against decks that are like, everybody's prepared, like tries to prepare for it. The problem is that you can't. The meta just can't adapt to this deck. It's too good. It fights through Leyline like it's nothing.
And I mean, Niv-Mizzet is not unique, where you basically are, you know, I don't know, less than 5% to win game one or something. And then you bring in all this sideboard hate. But, you know, as we talked about last week, when you basically are punting game one, the percentages to win game two and three have to be so high to turn that into a reasonable matchup. It's just not feasible. So I don't know that you did anything wrong, Dan. You might have just gotten caught up.
It just felt like every decision that I made that I felt like I had some agency over just got punished. It was a little frustrating. But yeah, that sub game you're talking about was so interesting because Andrew Welber's, I looked at his list and he was not playing Ley Lines for the mirror. He was playing Surgicals, probably for the same reason you're describing, where, yeah, he just wanted to make sure that the cards that he was bringing in would actually give him something. And Ley Lines, you just can't be sure. Like, Ley Lines sort of force you into these mulligan decisions that are not going to be that fun to navigate and may not even be rewarding if the Ley Line dies right away.
Yeah, well, to be fair, it's a little bit easier to lean on Surgical if your deck's plan A is to Hogak them out.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, that deck just needs to create a little bit of time, whereas Niv-Mizzet needs to create a lot of time.
Yeah, and also, Dan, I mean, remember that basically you got gacked, and it sounds like every single other person that Andrew played on basically both days also got gacked.
They did. Yeah, they did.
Lots of people that weekend got gacked. Lots of people get gacked every single day.
Even while we're recording this, someone is getting gacked.
Some poor fool is trying to actually play Magic on MTGO and learning a harsh lesson about the way of this world. So you guys played your Friday MCQ. You had some spotty results, but some encouraging results. And then did you make adjustments, it sounds like? You guys, your land count, you tweaked some of your other card choices kind of based on how you felt after that?
Just minuscule changes. Yeah, I decided that I just didn't want to do Field of Ruin anymore. I wasn't that happy with it. And so that became the third Bird of Paradise. We'd only played 2 birds on Friday. And then the other change we made was moving the Kaya Orzhov Usurper to the main deck. She had been in the sideboard previously. But the rest of the deck remained basically the same. Does that sound right, Dan? We, I think, changed one fetch land. We added an extra fetch land.
Yes, and we switched off our idea of having two snow mountains, two snow plains, one snow forest to having two snow forests and then one of everything else. And we forget why we ever did that in the first place.
Yeah, well, it turns out that if you are just looking for a snow land of any type on turn one because you don't have Birds of Paradise, then green is not that important. But if you're trying to cast a turn one bird, then green is like very important. Like, it turns out that like red and white are actually more important colors than green, sort of, in a lot of situations, in a lot of double spell situations. Because everything else in the deck is already green. Green producing land. But anyway, so I think the Saturday mana base, which is we'll post all three of these, was the better mana base, I felt. But yeah, so that's what we took to battle for the main event. I started with two buys, and Damon, you had one buy. My day did not start that well. I got gacked quite quickly in round three, where, you know, I gave away game one, as always, and game two. Like, it looked like, oh, if this hand, if I resolve this Kaya on turn three, I might actually win. And I missed a land drop. I missed my third land drop. I drew a birds instead, and that was over. And then I played a close one against Is It Phoenix, where, you know, we talked about how in our prep on Thursday, I felt like we got the matchup to a good place, and then I beat it again on Friday, but, like, this match just didn't quite bounce my way. Like, I ended up losing the die roll and lost game one very narrowly because of that, and similarly, I lost game three very narrowly, where both of those games, the card that killed me was Aria of Flame, followed by just like a one-turn kill with just a bunch of cantrips. The rest of the Niv deck is filled with removal for every kind of permanent, plenty of removal for creatures, and plenty for Aria of Flame, to be honest. I just didn't happen to have it at that exact one-turn window in each of those games, and my opponent just like had enough to Aria me out from 30 life, which is a little frustrating. So I was like quickly down to 2-2, bounced back with a couple of wins against Infect and, gosh, something else, and then rounded out the day with a couple of losses to red decks. A little disappointing because I felt like we had got those matchups to decent places, but decent means, you know, maybe 50-50, maybe 55-45, and you do have to lose some of those in order to arrive at that number, and I lost them. So I didn't feel terrible about that. I felt like, you know, I'm happy playing against those decks. I just happened to lose them this time. So I did not make day two.
Yeah, Dan, the match you forgot, I think I finished a match early and I got some food and went over to watch my friend play. And I show up and Dan has a birds and a land and his opponent has a Gristlebrand.
Oh my gosh. That's right.
And so I sit there eating my fries and chicken tenders, watching the opponent just kind of turn through their deck. And then at some point the opponent says, go. And then Dan points out the two packs in their graveyard, and the game ends.
That matchup was... Okay, I should say a little bit about that, because that was quite funny. So I was already quite demoralized from losing my first two rounds of the day, rounds three and four. And then to get paired against Neobrand in round five, which, you know, is not an unbeatable deck by any means, but we didn't have that many cards for it, because I didn't think anyone would be playing it. I actually just punted away the first game. I had the game won. I didn't even realize it. So I kept like what looked like a reasonable hand. I'd finally won a die roll for what felt like the first time in a number of rounds. And my hand had a bunch of lightning helixes and stuff and removal. So I was like, okay, I can survive. I can get to Niv. This time I'm going to like do it. As long as it's not Hogak, I'm going to do it. And then, you know, they play like a Temple of Mystery or whatever. And you're like, oh, damn. Stupid Neobrand deck. So he starts going off on turn three, draws his whole deck. And I'm realizing like, wait a second. If he goes for the Lab Maniac kill, like, you know, at least I can Lightning Helix it with us on that on the stack, just on the off chance that he hasn't drawn his Pact of Negation that they play main deck. So he went for it. He played the Lab Maniac, activated Gristlebrand. I played my Helix or whatever, and he passed, or he Pact of Negation, and I died. And then I'm like, you know, picking up my cards, and I look at my hand, and I'm like, wait a second, there was an abrupt decay in my hands. Like, what the hell? Can't be countered. Like, that would have actually won the game. I just totally blanked on that in my mind. I was so convinced I was dead that I didn't realize I actually had the trump card in my hand. Somehow managed to bounce back in games two and three because of that Cyborg Lavinia that we talked about, which completely shuts down the everything Neobrand is trying to do. So I tutored for that with Elite Emery's Call on turn two, played it on turn three. Opponent like reads the card. He's like, oh. He's like, well, I guess I'll respond with two Nourishing Shoals for 15 each. So he goes up to 50 life in response. So Lavinia just has to like attack him from 50 down to 0. The game ended with like me having to fight through a bunch of hard cast Chancellor of the Tangles and Gristlebrand, that sort of thing, which I still had removal to do. And then game 3, like because he feared Lavinia so much, he just had to go for it on turn 3, I think, or turn 2 or 3.
Turn 2.
He went for it on turn 2. The hand that we each mulliganed to 5, and the hand that I had kept is a charm to interact on turn 2. So, like, it was a good decision, I think, for him to try to go for it on turn 2, but, like, he basically had to hit exact ease off of his Crystal Brand, and he failed. He did fizzled out and died to his packs. So it's a funny match, and it turns out that if I had lost that match, I would have been eliminated from day 2, and I could have joined the standard MCQ that was about to fire with only 40-some people in it, but I didn't know that at the time. I was still alive, so I kept battling.
Yeah, you would have had to have gotten to play the best deck in the format, I think, of standard.
Oh, yeah, this is the Teamer Flash deck that you assembled at the last minute?
Yeah, I somehow decided to toss together a standard deck just in case I scrubbed out of the GP for the 3 p.m. standard MCQ. And Teamer Flash caught my eye for no particular reason. And so after scrambling around some vendors to find the last Lightning Strikes, I had it sleeved up and ready to go. And it was meant to be. It was meant to be that Dan would drop and then win the MCQ with Teamer Flash in the small tournament. But his uniform opponent couldn't get there.
I know. That was my day of Saturday, but Damon, you had a better run of this.
Yeah, yeah. And so just to preface, I'll probably post a tournament report to Reddit in the next day or two, because it was a relatively interesting day, I thought, to discuss. But yeah, so while Dan was busy chilling on Easy Street with his second round bye, I was fighting into Dredgegak. My notes are actually kind of unclear. I'm still not sure I know the difference between Dredgegak and Dredge featuring Hogak. But I actually managed to win game one because I found a Kaya's Guile, and my opponent's like first 20-ish cards that they dredged didn't do a whole lot. And so I sat there holding mana up, and then by the time I pulled the trigger, their deck was like 20 cards. And I was able to just sort of go over the top at that point. Next round, I was up against a guy that Dan had played the previous round on Dredge or Dredgegak or something. And I was like, I could consider, like, assuming he's on the same list, if it is even is the same guy, and mull to my best Hogak hands. I was like, who am I kidding? This isn't going to work. So I just kept a functional hand and just lost, just got crushed. Game two, I kept a hand that had, like, Lavinia and Surgical. Lavinia actually was surprisingly good all weekend as, like, this weird flex sideboard slot that is good in a surprising number of matchups. And so Lavinia basically shuts off Hogak and Conflagrate, or at least makes Conflagrate difficult. And so bought me of time. I actually decked my opponent. They went for the last 4 cards to find a Conflagrate, and I used a Teferi to instant speed Bring to Light for Kaya's Guile. My opponent looks at the board, looks to see if he could do lethal damage that turn, and since he's going to deck himself the next turn, he concedes. Go to game 3, and an Anafenza plus a Kaya plus an Assassin's Trophy managed to close it. Next round, I played against Jund, and after resolving a Niv game 1 to close things out, this guy wanders up and is like, is anybody here? I heard somebody around here is casting a Niv-Mizzet. And I was like, oh, that might be me. I don't know. Maybe somebody else, too. And so he's like, oh, if you win, and which is like a nice little clause to tell somebody in the middle of a match, I can come over for a deck tech feature. And so then promptly my opponent is like, this guy's not going to win. And he Junds me out hardcore with a discard Scooze Fulminator. He's out for blood. We're not getting this guy on a deck tech. And I'm like, oh, come on. And but then game 3, I managed to close it out. It was close for a bit, but his top deck tracker just couldn't match my top deck Niv. So we got to post a 30-second deck tech to Twitter. And that was an interesting experience. That landed me in the feature match area. I played against Tron. I didn't know it at the time, but I managed to find a turn 3 Unmoored Ego. Dan had basically told me before the tournament, oh, don't worry about Tron. I was like, we're not testing against Tron at all. I only have this like Alpine Moon and like a single Fulminator Mage. Like, are we really set for this matchup? He's like, yeah, we're fine against Tron. I usually win. I was like, oh, okay. Like, how do you win? And he's like, oh, I just Unmoored Ego them. I was like, okay.
That's the plan. Yeah, it's a one of, so I don't see why it wouldn't work, right?
Yeah, and it did work. So nobody expects the game 1 Unmoored Ego, I'll put it that way. Playing as Tron after you Unmoored Ego them is just this nice, like, relaxing experience. Instead of being like this stressful thing, like, will they find a Haymaker, like an Ulamog? You're like, I can handle the Karn, but not the Ulamog. Like, will they find it? And they cast Ancient Stirrings. You're like, do I counter this? Like, I don't know. When you've gotten rid of the Tron stuff on turn 3, and you just still have all your good interaction up, it's just like this nice, pleasant gameplay, quite enjoyable, really. And your Tron opponent is busy, like, thinking through carefully every line because I think things got a lot harder for them. Yeah, we go to game 2, and they don't have Tron on turn 3, and they do have an O-Stone, and then I actually found the one of Ego, no problem, cast it, and we again go to relaxation mode, although they made it close with the turn 4 Karn Great Creator into a Walking Ballista, but I managed to close it out with a Niv. Things took a turn for the worse next round. I lost to Unexpected Results Tron. my opponent mentions they like built a deck that week. This was the first time they'd played it or something like that. And I was like, okay, I'm curious to see what this is. And they just find Tron, no problem, game one. I try to trophy them, doesn't stop them at all. They play Unexpected Results, which, if you guys don't know that card, 2 blue and a green for a sorcery, shuffle your deck and then reveal the top card. You may cast it without paying its mana cost. If it's a land, you get to return it back to your hand to recast Unexpected Results. So he shuffles, I cut, and it goes cuts straight to Ulamog. I think I was losing the game anyway, but that made it easy, an easy decision to scoop.
And so because it casts, it gets the trigger from Ulamog or Emrakul in
it
that case, right?
Sure does, yeah. Game two, I messed up my mulligan a little bit. So as a result, my hand, instead of having a turn two Ice Fang, turn three Ego, instead as a turn two Ice Fang, turn three nothing, turn four nothing, turns 5 through 8 also nothing. My opponent is also not doing a whole lot either, but then he hard casts an Emrakul, the 15 mana one, and pack it in.
Yeah, that's a sign that you've done something wrong. You just know that the game has not gone according to plan. We should mention that was also a feature match. You had back-to-back feature matches in rounds 5 and 6. And you can see the Unexpected Results also got a video deck tech. This is all on the Channel Fireball Twitter feed. We'll put some links in the show notes as well. But yeah, go check out the coverage. Big shout-outs to Sam Ehlenfeld, I think, was the one doing the Twitter coverage.
Yep, he's the one.
Former top 8 competitor.
It was cool to get to watch your video deck tech, Damon, and to see a little bit from some of the players and some of the matchups and some of the decks. So appreciated Channel Fireball's effort on Twitter, at least.
Yeah, I think he did a great job with the sort of one-man coverage team that he asked him to do text and video and interesting feature matches and that kind of thing.
Yeah, Sam brought a lot of enthusiasm. He was very, very fun to interact with. I enjoyed chatting with him. But yeah, so then I go to the next match, and guess what my opponent's turn one land is? Versus Tower. I'm like, what is going on? And this match was interesting. My opponent mulled to 5 and then has turn 3 Tron into Wurmcoil, turn 4 Wurmcoil. Wurmcoil is a pretty good card against us. We don't have that many clean answers to it. We can answer it, but it requires like multiple cards. But somehow my opponent just draws only lands for about as long as I needed, which was maybe 10 turns in a row. And so I actually stabilized with Niv and a bunch of Helixes to steadily take down the Wurm tokens. And I won that game, even though they were like 50 life, and I was pretty far behind. And then games 2 and 3 were not super notable. Made day 2 at 6-1, and then went against humans. And then this deck has this thing where sometimes you just draw like a bunch of Lightning Helixes, and if your opponent's on humans or burn or something like that, the game just is like easy. And if they're on like Tron or Hogak, the game is hard. And my opponent here was on humans, and I just Helix this thing, Helix that thing, Niv, and then the game ends. One thing, by the way, Dan and I haven't been talking about is that we play these two cards, Tolsimir, Friend to Wolves, and Huntmaster of the Fells, and they both make wolves, and they both gain new life, and they both kill creatures. Tolsimir gives it with every wolf gets this ETB thing where it fights a creature, and Huntmaster, when he flips, deals 2 damage to a creature and 2 to your opponent. And these cards just put in like a ton of work for us all weekend. Like this Huntmaster flipped 1,000,000 times. Tolsimir just eats things for breakfast. They were surprisingly good. Dan, that was your experience too, right?
Oh yeah, it was like a breakout weekend for Tolsimir, Friend to Wolves, and for Voja, Friend to Elves as well. They're a team. And I have to credit you, Dave, with the Huntmaster because, you know, I chuckle every time you propose the card. I finally caved and put it in the deck, and it was really good.
Would it have been good if it didn't have a wolf to work with your 5-drop there? It just was generally a powerful card?
I never actually combined them. It was just like nice to get 2 threats on the board. Yeah, they tended to eat removal, but that was fine. Like, gave me something to like do to sort of bridge to the end game. And in some cases, yeah, I was able to flip it back and forth.
I combined the two many times, and it was just... it was enjoyable. I had a good time with the two working together.
So it says whenever a wolf enters play, the 2/2 wolf that the Huntmaster makes gets to both fight if you want and gain another 3 life. Is that what it does?
Yep. So against humans in the game 2, I like stabilize at 1 life after a verdict, and they're like, hey, he's at 1 life. I could like maybe win if I play some dudes. And he untaps and he plays like a Thalia's Lieutenant. And I was like, Tolsimir is a friend to wolves, and Voja is a friend to elves, and neither are friends of humans. My opponent is like, it was just like their guy dies and they untap and they're like, well, I can play this champion. And I'm like, Huntmaster, get a wolf, trigger Tolsimir, fight your champion.
Oh, wow. That's amazing.
Yeah, I was not going to let a top deck Mantis Rider finish me that game. Yeah, and then round 9, I'm playing against Blue-White Control, managed to flood out both times. I managed to also accumulate some warnings. I was extremely tired by then, and those games were just sad. I don't really want to talk about them too much.
The less said, the better.
They were a bit sad. I got to watch that round in its entirety. It was sad. Best left for the tournament report. So that was Saturday. You were 7-2, though. That was sweet.
Yeah, it was a great result, and then we got some delicious Vietnamese food after. Should we talk about day 2?
Well, where did you guys go for Vietnamese food? I mean, let's get the story here.
Oh, well, okay, so if you are in the Twin Cities or you're visiting the Twin Cities, Nicollet Avenue, as you go south toward Uptown, becomes Eat Street with a lot of, I guess, I don't know what you call them, ethnic restaurants, that kind of thing. But a lot of Mexican places, a lot of Vietnamese places, and other cuisines as well. And there's always been this establishment called Quang's Vietnamese, by 28th and Nicollet. And we got there, I was really excited to go, and it was just like so packed that we had to quickly recalculate the plan, which meant going across the street to Huang's, my Huang, and that was actually amazing.
That's a basement restaurant, right?
Is it a basement restaurant?
It wasn't in a basement.
It was in like a sort of unimpressive strip mall. It was like more of like a kitchen restaurant.
Yeah.
They didn't put much into the presentation, but the food was immaculate. I loved it.
It was so good.
So good that we tried to go back there on Sunday. They were closed for some reason, so we had to go to Quang's. I like Quang's too, but My Hong or whatever it's called, that's a great restaurant.
Yeah, it's an awesome restaurant.
Do you know this place, Dave?
I know both of them quite well. I lived in Uptown for all my 20s, so. A lot of hot spots. Also, the chances that you hear a fucking hipster white person call it Quang's is basically like Vegas has taken that off the board instead of Quang.
I mean,
which is just great.
I do not remember that restaurant being so popular with the hipster crowd, but it was jam-packed on both Saturday and Sunday. All kinds of people who were not there when I was a kid. Anyway, that was our Saturday. I decided that since I was going to play the Sunday MCQ, they have an MCQ again for anyone who didn't make day 2, that I decided to make a couple changes to the deck. The biggest one being that I was just so sick of the Leyline Dance, so discouraged by it, that I decided to move back to Rest in Peace in the sideboard. The biggest driver of that decision was that I felt like a large part of the reason why I lost my last two rounds to those Red Phoenix decks was because I had Leylines instead of Rest in Peace. The Red Phoenix is the kind of deck where you can afford to wait a couple turns to deploy your Rest in Peace, and you do want to clean up the things in the graveyard to prevent them from casting Revelers and to clean up any stray Lava Darts or Faithless Lutings or Phoenixes that have already snuck their way into the grave. And if you can't clean up their graveyard, you might not actually be able to survive the continued reloading. So the fact that all my graveyard hate pieces were pretty much Leylines, and that's not good against the Red Phoenix deck, because you look at your opening hand, the most important thing to have is a Lightning Helix. And it's nice to have a Leyline too, but you can't like keep or mold a hand on the strength of a Leyline against the Red decks. But you can keep a hand that has a Lightning Helix if you're expecting to draw a Rest in Peace in like the first 5 turns or something like that.
Yeah, so 2 interesting points there. One, I think that's an interesting thing that has not been discussed enough about Hogak is Leyline is weirdly a card that's like only good against Hogak and maybe Dredge. Other decks that kind of use the graveyard, having this 4 mana card later in the game is like much worse. And 2, the mono red prowess decks, I looked at multiple deck lists from the top 16 and they were wildly different. Some had 4 Phoenix, some had none. Some had 4 of the 8 mana prowess guys, some had none, some had 1. There's no agreed upon build, but that deck in general, in aggregate, had the best record, which I thought was weird. So I think Ryan Overturf is the one that did the best in the top 8, and I don't think he played any Phoenix at all.
Correct. He does coverage for Star City sometimes.
Yeah, he's been advocating this deck and has absolutely been just like tearing people up with this. So shout outs to him. But yeah, shout outs to everybody else. I mean, this deck seems like it's really interesting that so many varying builds of this deck are still seeing a lot of success, even in this super kind of high power format with Hogak running around.
I think Ryan Overturf's deck is going to get more popular because he basically called his shots. He wrote about this deck the week before, went on to crush the tournament. He had like no buys, and he ends up finishing in, what, 3rd place or something? And then he wrote an article about it on Star City Today, actually. Yeah, it's 4 Beldum Revelers. He does not have any way to remove a Rest in Peace. So, like, if you land a Rest in Peace, you're a long way towards beating that deck. So give the rest in peace a chance. My results against Hogak couldn't really get any worse.
Yeah,
exactly. Why not give the Rips a chance? So that's the main change I made going into Sunday. I tweaked a couple of cards. Like, I cut the Ice Fang Quetal, which I hadn't really been finding that impactful. Yeah, there's nothing wrong with the card, but it just doesn't actually address any of the main weak matchups. So I cut that as well. I went down to 2 Ren and 6, because I found that that card was also like not really helping against these red decks or against Hogak. I kind of started to question, like, how important is that card if I'm always siding it out? So I went down to 2, and I actually liked my Sunday list quite a bit better. So yeah, I was battling with an updated list. Damon, you were playing day 2 of the main event. Damon, do you want to talk about your rounds?
Yeah, day 2 was somehow, went by fast. I wasn't playing my best at the start. Started off against Eldrazi Tron, which is supposed to be a good matchup, and I believe it after playing it sort of by the end of the tournament, but this match I just got crushed. It was just like they just killed me super fast with Thought on Seers and Smashers. The next round I played against Boros Burn. My opponent was on the play with a Goblin Guide, Swift Spear, Swift Seer draw, and I did not find a Lightning Helix, which is basically, do you draw a Lightning Helix? And if you do, you actually have a pretty good chance, and if you don't, it's going to be really hard to win. Kai's Guile is maybe also equally good. Game 2, they have Turn 1 Goblin Guide, Turn 2 Goblin Guide, Swift Spear. I maybe should have mulled to Lightning Helix, but I didn't, and then I just died. So start off the day 0-2. That was kind of sad. Round 3, I play against Eldrazi Tron again. So I've been playing as Tron just like all day and all the last day. And somehow, in the world of Hogak, I'm just in the Tron, like Urza world. Game 1, my opponent mulls, and then I Thought Erasure, their only threat. The game just goes on forever because I don't find Niv fast enough to really close things out fast. Game 2 was super close. My first Niv hit only 2 cards, a Dovin's Veto and Assassin's Trophy. And then at some point, I have them down to 2 life, and they find their Congrate Creator, and they get in the Snaring Bridge. And then if I can't kill them this turn, they're going to be able to Lattice me next turn. I draw Eldamri's Call, which I have enough mana to play Eldamri's Call into Niv into 2 drop. And so if I find one of either a Lightning Helix, an Abrupt Decay, or an Assassin's Trophy, I can kill the Bridge or Karn and win, but I did not. I hit a Teferi Decay command. So I scoop, and there's only 5 minutes on the clock, and so we get an unintentional draw, which kind of sucks for both of us, really. Just not that good of an outcome. But then in the draw bracket, I got rewarded by playing against humans, which is just, this is a pretty good match. They occasionally can just do their humans thing and win. But game 1, I have a turn 1 birds into Teferi, bounce your Vial. And my opponent was counting on the Vial because they missed their land drop. And so then I decay the Vial. And then the game actually gets close because they drew all 4 Thalia's Lieutenants that game. And that's just like one of their best cards. But I resolved a Niv, and then I just got Tolsimir and the Wolves to close things out. I just stayed on defense for a while because I was at low life, but I flipped the Huntmaster a few times, and there are just Wolves everywhere. It was funny because Dan and I didn't have like any official Wolf tokens, and those are also hard to find on last minute at a GP. But we went to this artist booth and bought these Ken Myers Jr.
That's right, Ken Myers Jr.
Yeah, and so he had Wolf tokens for sale, and so we got this like pretty sweet, pretty metal drawing of like a wolf howling at the moon, and that became Voja, and then a couple wolves just chilling in front of some like Greek building. Those became the Huntmaster token. So just enjoyable getting to bust these out every time Tolsimir came to town.
Couple of wolves just hanging out, yeah. The beefcake werewolf
howling at the moon.
That was fun.
Yeah. Yeah, and so then I win that match in 3. My opponent actually had a really cool humans deck. They had like a beautiful foiled out humans with this really sweet foiled out miscut Mantis Rider. It was just like a very interesting card to see. Whereas like one of those like vertical miscuts where you see like the bottom third at the top and then the top 2/3 at the bottom. Those are rare.
Yeah.
So anyways, I go to the last 14th round, and I guess I play against another Tron player. Oof. And I managed to totally punt game 1. The deck really wanted me to be on the play with an Unmoored Ego, and I managed to not have my mana set up right to cast it on turn 3 because I decided to cast a Ren and 6 on turn 2. So that was just complete mess up. Whoops.
You failed to fetch the blue source on turn 2?
Correct.
That's a scenario where, like, because you had a Pillar of the Parons as your third land, like, having this 5-color source is actually really good. Like, I just fundamentally disagree with people who want to cut the pillars. You easily could have gone, you know, Ren and 6 into Unmoored Ego if you just remembered to fetch a Breeding Pool on turn 2.
Yeah.
Pillar is great.
Pillar is great. Also, just not screwing up is also great. Oops. But then game two, I mulled to five and I have an ego. Again, ego against Tron. Things are nice and fun. Nice, fun, fair magic. Game three, my opponent mulls to five, and then Lavinia actually slows him down a bit, and then I finally trophy one of their lands and then unmoored ego to clean the rest out. The game is close, but managed to path a Wyrmcoil and win with Tulsimir. Go into the last round and decide to ID because there's a small chance that if I lose, I won't get anything, and if I ID, I will guarantee that I cash. And if I win, there's a decent chance I get like a little bit more money. My opponent won the die roll. Turns out they're on Hogak, so I managed to dodge Hogak by playing them in the 15th round.
Nice.
Yeah.
You found the line to finally exactly. ID with Hogak once and for all. An uneasy truce was reached with Hogak.
Yeah. So I finished 9-4-2, so 94th out of 980 players. I cashed for $250, which paid for approximately half the plane tickets, so great value there.
I mean, yeah. Apart from the whole prize structure, though, like, man, this is, like, a big deal. This is the first time that I think anyone's played Niv-Mizzet to a big finish in an actual large tournament like this, and you cashed, which is awesome.
Yeah, it was a blast. I had a great time.
The deck is becoming real. You got a deck tech, you got featured, you get getting some Niv-Mizzet love out there, and I think we learned a lot about the deck list.
Yeah, for sure. We came out of the weekend knowing a lot more than we did knowing going in.
So what are your takeaways going forward? Let's just sort of ignore the Hogak thing. I think we all kind of understand it's too powerful for the format. It will be banned. Aaron Forsyth said it won't be emergency banned, so they've decided to let Las Vegas be ruined. But in the future, in a non-Hogak world, yeah, talk about sort of your recommendations for the build going forward after all you guys have learned.
So one thing is, I think we need a little bit more juice against blue-white. It should be a good matchup. I mean, basically, almost always they just have to tap low enough that you can resolve a Niv. Or the alternative is that basically just they can never cast a Planeswalker until they have like 10 lands in play. And even if they wait that long, you still might be able to resolve a Niv because you'll have a lot of resources up too. And so they have to play this really scaredy cat game, but sometimes that works. And it's disappointing when it does. It feels like resolving a Niv should be good enough. So we were discussing maybe even like a Thrun. And so Thrun has this big problem that he's not castable off Pillar. He's not findable off Niv. But we do have Eldamri's Call to find the Thrun reliably, and modern blue-white just doesn't play any answers to it. They don't have any Terminus-type cards. It's actually pretty good in that case right now.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm not really a believer in Thrun, but hearing you describe how problematic he is for blue-white, I'm sort of persuaded that, yeah, that could be a trump if the matchup turns out to be a problem. I think the first thing I would do, if Hogak were gone and I had more sideboard space, I would definitely play a third Teferi Time Raveler in the sideboard, which is what I actually did in my Sunday list. That can solve a lot of your problems right off the bat if they just can't counter your stuff. Dovin's Veto is a wonderful card in not just this matchup, but actually a number of miscellaneous matchups. You can even turn to something like a big Teferi, or you just need like more threats against blue-white. We talked about Modern Streamers League. One of the streamers involved is playing Niv-Mizzet. He had a crazy match against blue-white on camera in week 5. They just like went back and forth killing all of each other's threats, and he ended up decking out the blue-white player with an Ashiok at the end of the game or something.
Wow.
Many, many Nivs were resolved, and many of them got pathed, and many got de-sphered and stuff. You need to like leave in cards that you wouldn't expect you have to leave in. Like, you should leave in the Lightning Helixes, just because you have to be able to pick off their Narsets and Jaces and Little Teferis, that kind of thing. So that matchup is one that, it's a little frustrating when you lose it, because you feel like, I should be able to beat this deck. I have all five colors at my disposal. Why is it so hard? That is a matchup that will become winnable once there's more sideboard space available. That's my hope, anyway.
Yeah.
I guess the other takeaway that I had that was sort of solidified for me on Sunday, where I was able to get back on the winning track. I guess I forgot to talk about how my Sunday MCQ went, but basically I got gacked in round one, so I was eliminated from top 8 contention immediately by Andrew Wahlbergs again. But then I won my next 4 rounds, including beating Hogak finally in round 5 and took the ID in round 6. But like I won against, you know, a miscellany of fun tier 2 and 3 decks. I just like mopped them up. Niv-Mizzet is excellent at just like wiping the floor with these miscellaneous decks that people are registering in modern leagues. If you can just trade with their stuff, you will just overwhelm them very, very easily. So I'm talking about like stuff like I played against the Red-White Prison, I played against the Blue-Red Kiki-Jiki deck, Taking Turns deck. I mean, these were just like landslide victories for me. kind of reminded me, like, oh yeah, that's right. Against the field, this Niv-Mizzet is an overwhelming choice. Like, and it's not a super competitive only Hogak red and blue-white field. Niv-Mizzet has a lot of easy matchups out there. It's just going to bump up a tier after a banning, hopefully. It really benefits from having fewer pressures on its sideboard and on its opening hands. We can start to entertain things like maybe we don't need all four Lightning Helix's main, or maybe we can play extra Planeswalker threats, or whatever the case may be.
Well, this Prowess deck isn't going anywhere, so I suspect we'll still want to keep the Helixes. They're just so good in so many matchups.
That's true.
There's like very few matchups where they're bad.
True. And yeah, I found that like some of the problems that we had been having way back before Horizons even, if you think back to the struggles we had against Blood Moon in like week two of our podcast, those are basically gone. Like I beat so many Blood Moon decks. And I think Damon, you had a good time against Blood Moon too. This Snow plus Pillar plus Astrolite mana base is actually quite resilient, quite good, and not actually weak to Blood Moon. You could even play Blood Moon yourself if you wanted to. It's that good at finding the basics and color fixers. So the weaknesses of the deck are, we're checking them off little by little.
Yeah, it's almost a little bit disgusting like how this deck plays this five-color mana base, and like this is not your typical five-color control that's like pretty biased towards a few colors of the five and then splashes a couple cards from the other ones. Like, this is really five colors, and you really need the five colors early. And the mana base actually delivers that quite reliably. I felt like I had them all fairly, you know, more than a normal deck would, but it was fine.
Dave, how does this all sound to you? You've been around since the beginning for this deck.
I haven't seen the games. I want the deck to be very good. So my experience playing this style of deck has always been that it feels a little slow. But yeah, it's interesting how comfortable you guys are feeling against humans or other decks like that that I feel like sometimes can just sort of nut draw.
Oh, you'll lose to the humans nut draw. It's okay. I mean, like the humans nut draw actually is just really good. On the play with the right draw, we have a chance actually, which is something that not a lot of decks can say.
Yeah, that's a good point. And like you say, you can even switch some of the cards you're playing. Like, you wouldn't have to play a main deck and a Fenza, for instance, if Hogak was banned. Right, Dan?
Oh, yeah.
So, you start getting slots back that let you, you know, repair or patch up some of these other matchups. So, yeah, I actually think it's very encouraging, sort of in the hypothetical, but hopefully very likely future world, where we can start playing Magic again.
Yeah. There's one last thing I'd like to discuss quickly. So, this is actually, I think we discussed a little bit obliquely, and that's when building the sideboard, is it better to have, for example, let's just say like the universal best answer, for example, or a perhaps slightly worse gilded answer that you can hit off Niv? The tension being that if you have the slower, like the premier answer, it's better to have in your opener, but if you have the gilded one, it's much better if you hit a Niv and you can reload, and your reload actually includes cards meant for the sideboarded matchup.
The two cards that come to mind when you say that are Wheel of Sun and Moon and Ashiok Dreamrender.
In the graveyard context, yeah.
For example, let's say we were trying to think of cards that are useful against graveyards. I mean, those both do miscellaneous things. Do we want those, or do you want something a little bit stronger that is not gold? Path to Exile is another one that comes to mind. Like, do you want Path to Exile in the sideboard, or do you want like more Maelstrom Pulses or something? Or Detention Spheres?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, like, there were times where Path was actually quite good just because it was cheap. Looking as humans, like Path, sometimes it just gets you out of a pinch in a hurry. Or gets you out in a pinch? Whatever that saying is.
Out of a pinch.
Out of a pinch. Against humans. But then there are times where, like, yeah, you play a Niv, and the Niv flips over your paths, and you're like, I wish I had those be things I could use right now. Like, if that was a G-Sphere, that'd be great. Or even, like, some weird cards like Unmake. But that one's casting cost is probably a little bit too difficult.
Oh, I thought you were joking about that. I didn't think that was actually a serious suggestion you were going to say on the cast. That makes it terrible. What?
It is terrible, but it's sort of in the right direction of the conversation. If it was like only dual-colored, for example, Anguish Unmaking, I think, is also not quite good enough, but that one is also interesting.
And another consideration is, because it is a Bring to Light deck, right, is do you want your specific card to be Bring to Lightable whenever possible? That was another consideration I was always sort of kicking around.
Yeah, absolutely. And the two cards that come to mind for that are the Big Teferi, a wonderful, excellent win condition at 5 mana, but you can't find it off Bring to Light. And Detention Sphere, which is probably much better than Maelstrom Pulse in all scenarios, but you can Bring to Light for a Pulse, you cannot Bring to Light for a Detention Sphere.
I always favored the 1-3 creature version of the detention sphere, specifically because it was Bring to Lightable.
Yeah, interesting. I actually played Deputy Detention in my 1K list from 2 weeks ago. I didn't like it that much, so I cut it. But yeah, so like there are some decisions that where I felt like you and I, Damon, mostly reached some consensus. Like, I liked the paths, and I think that the philosophy behind it makes sense to me, that the function of the sideboard is not to get a bunch of value off Niv, it's to shore up the weakest matchups, where the thing that matters most is, like, can you kill their prowess creature on turn one on the draw, and path can do that, whereas these other cards can't. You just have to accept that you're going to have weaker Niv hits. Like, that match I referenced where I hit only one card off Niv Mizzet, I still won that. I hit only a Bring to Light, and I Bring to Light for a path and won the game with it. Like, you don't need to win by a mile post-sideboard. Sometimes it's just about, like, identifying the critical juncture at which they either pull too far ahead of you or in which you, like, start to double spell and turn the game around. So I think that, like, these cheaper cards like Path are important. Rest in Peace is much better than Ashiok or Wheel of Sudden Moon or whatever. That's my feeling, at least. Similarly, I like Crumple to Dust. Even though it's not a gold card, because it's just like a very strong card against Tron, and I bring it in a lot of matchups, rather than just say like overloading on Fulminator Mages or whatever else you might be inclined to do if you were sticking to the gold paradigm.
Yeah, although weirdly against Twiddlestorm, Crumble to Dust is useless, and you're going to want Alpine Moon instead.
That's true. I mean, that was, yeah, the two schools of split on that point. I saw you cast an Alpine Moon on a great turn, and then he blast zoned to the next turn, but it bought you enough time to win anyway, so it was interesting to see that happen.
Yeah.
So, can I say just like a couple things about the more contentious choices we made in the deck list?
Yeah, please do.
When I say contentious, I'm talking about if you either are looking through the published 5-0 lists, of which there are numerous now, or if you are joining or thinking of joining the Niv-Mizzet Discord, you will find people with different opinions about these things. The cards I want to highlight specifically off the top of my head: Supreme Verdict, Elid Emry's Call, Lightning Helix, How Many Do You Play, Ice Fang Quetzal, and Renin 6. Those are the ones that come to mind off the top of my head.
Maybe Bloodbraid Elf?
Bloodbraid Elf. Yeah, and Tolsimir. We already touched on those. But so basically, yeah, Tolsimir we loved, and I think that card should be accessible game one. I think that guy's locked for me, at least, going forward. Supreme Verdict is one that I had already moved to the sideboard 2 weeks ago. The reason for that was I just hadn't been facing any very many decks where you needed a verdict in game one. I still want it. It's the most important tool in the matchups where you need a Wrath. But like, if those are the minority of matchups, why not just have it in the sideboard? And the reason I think that's fine is because if you're playing against a creature deck, you already have plenty of stuff that kills creatures. It's not like you're dead game one without a verdict. You have helixes and stuff. You are fine in game one against a creature deck, and you can get even better with a verdict game two. But in the other matchups that are not about creature combat or a creature rush, your verdict is just dead in game one. So, like, why do that? If it's not like a unique effect, like, I have a different feeling about Unmoored Ego. Like, that card, even though it is often dead in game one, like, actually just, like, straight up wins games that no other card can win. And Verdict is not like that, in my opinion. Verdict is a more of what you already have. So for that reason, I think it's not a lock in the main deck, and I'm happy with it in the sideboard.
Yeah, Unmoored Ego actually is interesting. Even when it's dead, it's never that dead. There were a lot of games where I was either perhaps losing game one, but I fired off an Unmoored Ego, and at least I got to see their entire deck, which is no small advantage. Obviously, I prefer if it was like a card that would win the game, but a lot of the times I was losing it, it was like, I don't know what it would have been that out of Demir Colors that was going to stabilize.
True. The pickings are slim. Okay, so the second card, Ice Fang Quetzal. So this is one that I also mentioned that I ended up cutting it on Sunday. You know, it feels a little bad cutting this card because there's nothing wrong with it. It's a wonderful little cantrip creature. We have snow, so it will often have Death Touch. It's good at what it does. So why cut it? And I think for me it came down to the fact that, like, it's not really excellent in any matchup. Or the times when it is excellent are matchups where you're pretty much fine already. So when it's a question of, like, finding room for more specialized cards, Ice Fang's just sort of eating up a slot, and it's not really moving the needle for you in any given matchup. It's just, like, it's a nice card to have, but it's not that important, if that makes sense. And it's competing with Bring to Light in the Simic slot, so it's not like it's the only Simic card that you can play.
Yeah, and I think actually that's an important point. I liked Ice Fang. I thought it was good at being a blocker against Tarmogoyfs or Colonnades or all sorts of things. humans cards, prowess cards, you name it, Ice Fang blocks them. But the big problem is that, yeah, the Simic slot, if you play a Niv and you flip it, you really almost always want to take Bring to Light, because that lets you cast another Niv as needed or go find any specific piece. And so almost always, if your choice is Ice Fang or Bring to Light, Ice Fang is the wrong choice. That makes it almost like a dead Niv hit as a result, which I think puts it a little below the line for making the deck to me.
Yeah, I don't want to oversell that. I mean, I think you're fine playing as many as five or six of a guild. If you happen to hit two of them off one Niv hit, that's a little unlucky, but it happens.
Oh, but the difference here is that I think that's fine if it happens, if there's like sometimes one card is the right choice, sometimes the other card is the right choice, and you're just getting the better of two good choices. And so both cards deserve their spot at the table. But here, if your choice is always going to be Bring to Light, then I don't see that the Ice Fang Coattle really deserves a spot.
I see what you're saying. So Dave, how do you feel about that? Because you love Ice Fang Coattle in general.
I do, although I kind of agree with Damon's take on this. I think Bring to Light is so powerful in this deck, and I don't want to like find any more Simic slots. I think one of the reasons I was very attracted to Renin 6 is because we were always struggling to find like gruel cards we wanted to play. So here's a card that sort of like fit with the general plan and was a gruel hit, you know, to kind of increase the power of the Niv-Mizzet.
Yeah, so if you are playing Ice Fang, like, I don't hate you for that. I think that's a great card. But don't be afraid to slide it out and, you know, don't feel like, oh, I need to leave this in. Maybe you don't. Maybe if you have some sideboard cards you feel like are really going to move the needle, like, just cut the Ice Fang. You're really not going to miss it. The next card that I actually, that you and I, Damon, had really argued about on Thursday was Illidamri's Call. This is the white-green instant speed tutor for a creature from your deck, and this was our sort of seventh Niv-Mizzet. Like, so we played three actual Niv-Mizzets, three Bring to Lights, and then we wanted a seventh Niv-Mizzet. Some people do that by playing a fourth Bring to Light. Some people do it by playing a Glittering Wish, or sometimes multiple Glittering Wishes, and putting their extra Niv in the board. I was advocating Illidamri's Call, and after this weekend, I kind of stand by that. I think that actually opens up important lines that the other cards do not open up. I think the most direct comparison is probably to Glittering Wish. So my thought process briefly is the following. So in many situations, the actual best card you can have is the natural Niv-Mizzet. It's not vulnerable to things like Bailey attacks, Spell Pierce, Force of Negation. It's not colded by Teferi Time Reveler the way that Bring to Light is. You're much more likely to just like resolve a naturally drawn Niv-Mizzet, but he himself is not a Niv hit, whereas Bring to Light is. Illidamri's Call finds you the natural Niv, so in that sense, like, it's better at getting your best copy of Niv, if that makes sense. It itself both finds and is found by Niv in the same way that Bring to Light is. So it does add 2 mana to the cost of whatever creature you cast. That's a little bit of a downside, but on the flip side, it isn't instant. This deck likes to play at instant speed, so you can often just sort of pass the turn with your mana up, and you're holding removal, but often you'll find that you don't need to use it, and you have time to cast the call. So it's easy to sort of find a turn to cast an instant speed Illidamri's Call. It is not so easy to find a turn to play a sorcery speed Glittering Wish and just sort of be tapped out. So that's, I think, one point in favor of Call versus Wish, which has the same mana cost and guild affiliation. The second major point on Illidamri's Call versus Glittering Wish is that I think the Wish really screws with your sideboarding plans. This is a card I don't have a ton of experience with, so maybe I'm just doing it wrong. But let's just say, for example, you're playing against Neobrand or a graveyard deck, and the card you want is either Lavinia or Anaphens of the Foremost. If you have a Call main deck, that means that in games 2 you side in your Lavinia or your Anaphensa. You now have 2 copies of that card in the main deck. Whereas with Glittering Wish, you will never have 2 copies of the card in your main deck. You either leave the Wish in, and then you have to like wish for it in the sideboard games, or you bring the card in, but now your Wish is not a second copy. If that makes sense.
Yeah, so Wish is your first copy game 1, but then it does not function as a copy in games 2 and 3.
Yeah, so I just like don't like Glittering Wish in general. I mean, I can see why it's never a bad card. You could replace the Unborn Eagle with it in the main deck and feel like every time you draw the Glittering Wish, you're like, oh, I'm going to get something off this that I actually want, but that's going to be slow, it might be awkward to cast, and then it gets a lot less good in games 2 and 3. I think Call is just very clean. The number of times that we called for something other than Niv, I think was important. Like, I called for Tolsimir a number of times, I called for Anaphensa, called for Lavinia to win a match, so I was very happy with Illidamri's Call, and I think the instant speed is a huge difference over something like Glittering Wish. What do you guys think about that?
especially at the point that your Anafenza becomes a main deck card, Eladamri's Call just becomes much, much better. At the point that we really have a credible but small toolbox of creatures to call for. The cost is real. 2 mana is not only just 2 mana, but requiring green and white. Anytime you require these colors, it just you have to jump through a little bit of hoops to find the specific colors required, especially after Prismatic Vista. And I did actually, like, literally that game against Eldrazi Tron where I had to call for Niv and as a result could not cast a K command after Niv found it. I got a draw that match because I lost that game, and that was because of call not being a Niv. That said, yeah, it feels like maybe if we're doing things right, you'll lose games equally often to drawing Niv when it was better a Bring to Light versus a Bring to Light when it's better a Niv, or Eldrazi's Call better a Bring to Light, etc., etc. If we lose games to each of those equally, then it feels like we're in the right equilibrium.
They're all equally bad.
That's what you want, literally. To be at the point where adding, they're each equally good. So that there's no correct cut out of the three. They're each equally cuttable.
But to sort of emphasize part of what Damon said there, I think having a lot of or real creature options is important. If you can call for things that aren't just Niv-Mizzet, then you start to sort of justify the card's existence. You're also suggesting, you know, don't play the Ice Fang. That's, you know, a card you could find at instant speed and play at instant speed, just as one possibility that would maybe make that card even more attractive.
Yeah, and I partly reacting to a build that I played where I wanted to try 2 copies of Eladamri's Call, and as a result, I think I maybe tricked myself into playing bad hits like Sin Collector.
Mm.
It was just terrible. The card was just an embarrassment, and the Deputy of Detention, which I played over Detention Sphere because it was a Eladamri's Call target, and it just wasn't quite what I wanted. I needed the cards to be actually gone, not like, oh, surprise, they came back because they killed your deputy. So there were limits to that. I like the idea of like, oh, this call will grab a whole nice toolbox of stuff in game one, plus my sideboard hate bears. I guess where I'm at now is that, like, okay, you don't need all that cute stuff. Just in terms of like finding the Niv, which is almost always a target, or the specific hate card, whether that's Lavinia, Anafenza, Campbell, or like Tolsimir in certain board states where you're low on life. That in itself is just good enough. I think that's good enough, and that justifies the call spot for me.
Fair enough.
Yeah, I agree. One call. I like it.
Last 2 points were Lightning Helix. I think we just need to stay on all four, and I think, Damon, you were saying something similar to that. Some people want to trim down to 3 or 2. There was a list published today in the 5-0 dumps that only had 1, which I thought was crazy. I do not recommend that. And Renin 6, do we have more to say about this?
Nah, we said a lot.
Yeah. You don't have to play this. It's pretty good. It probably would be better if we were playing Tranquil Thicket, but I don't know if the mana can support that.
Yeah, and we don't have a way to find a lone Tranquil Thicket either.
True, yeah. So basically, like, the meta has kind of already adjusted to Renin 6 and Lava Dart. The concurrent entrance of those two into the format has really pushed out a lot of these one toughness creatures. Like, there are very few targets left for the Renin 6 ping. So don't play this card expecting it to like mop up infecting humans all day long. Like, yeah, if you hit those matchups, great, but they're not that common anymore. It's mostly just like a land, draw land. Maybe Ultimate wants a tournament, but probably not. So drawing a land is very, very good, but I don't think it's like the gospel truth, which I think some people do. You don't need 3 or 4.
Speaking of Lightning Helix, what do you guys think about Oath of Kaia, the sort of more expensive cousin of Lightning Helix?
That's really interesting.
That card seems slightly too slow for Modern.
What do you think of it, Dave?
Well, I notice we only are playing Kaia's Guile as our Orzhov hit, and maybe in a world where we aren't as concerned with Hogak, that card becomes less attractive, or you found all modes to be useful, so this is a card you'd play regardless of that?
I think Kaia's Guile is a lock for me as a one of because of the ability to bring to light for the Exile Graveyard effect in game one. If you think back to our original 5-0 list way back when, we had Primal Command, which we quickly identified as very problematic off Pillar of the Parents, but the most common mode there was like gain 7 and shuffle the graveyard in. So Kaia's Guile does that on turn 3, you know, you gain 4 and shuffle the graveyard in. It's just like, a very flexible card. Kills Awoken Horror, kills Thought Not Seer, whatever the case may be.
Kills Reality Smasher without the discard, although sometimes it misses because they have a Mattery Shaper out.
Yeah, even counters a Snapcaster Mage. So it's just like too versatile to give it up. But I think Oath of Kaya as an additional Orzhov hit is worth considering. I personally like Kaya Orzhov Usurper better, and we actually, in our Saturday deck list, we end up moving Kaya to the main deck.
It's also just more interesting as you guys are adding more and more Planeswalkers to the list. You know, I know we've seen in various deck dumps a certain number. At various points, it looks like you guys are up to like 7 or 6 Planeswalkers. The secondary text also becomes interesting, you know, when they are forced to attack Teferi to kill it, or they're forced to prevent Ren and Six from ultimating. You know, that's maybe a rare but possible bonus.
No, I do like that. That's interesting.
The problem is it's just sorcery speed. I feel like that just puts it over the edge. Kaya's Guile is weird because, like, it was printed straight to Modern, and so as a result, like, it hasn't picked up a ton of steam, but it's like, and like, Orzhov colors are not super Modern staples. But the card is, like, sneakily powerful, and it, like, even though it is occasionally dead, it is occasionally quite live. There's a lot of matchups where it comes in really big, and then the fact that it's really good against all the top meta decks besides maybe Tron right now, it's so against blue-white. This card is locked also for me.
You can balance off the Kaya with a Teferi, if that's interesting.
Oh, that's true.
It's a little slow, it's a little greedy, but I like where your head is at, Dave. This is a deck for the greedy.
And people who love gold cards.
Yeah. I think that about covers the cards that stood out to me where I felt like we reached some conclusions about them. There are more cards where, anecdotally, like I hated Ashiok, for example, but we need to play more games with it to say really for sure. So I think we can just leave it at that for now. We'll post our deck lists and people can compare them and see what they like. There's so many flex slots in the deck. Yeah, you're going to see a wide variation in the lists that are 5-0ing and doing well. But I liked our versions. I really did.
Yeah. I thought the deck felt like it played out quite well for me. Clearly, the deck has some weird constraints around the cards in it, and I don't think we're anywhere near the final version, but we're getting a lot closer. The deck is getting a lot better, a lot smoother.
Yeah. Should we just wrap up this discussion then? Like, my takeaway for the weekend was that this deck is actually poised to become quite good. We were playing at the height of the Hogak Broken Summer, and our overall win rate was pretty good. I mean, Damon, you kind of carried us, but between the two of us, we posted a 60% win rate, 21 wins, 14 losses. This is not counting buys. You went 12-6 with a 1 draw. I went 9-8. 4 of my losses were to Hogak decks, so like, if we removed that, yeah, I actually did pretty well. I wasn't discouraged at all by the losses, apart from getting gacked. I think that you're going to be hearing a lot more from this deck, about this deck. It is poised to become a real player in Modern in the next couple weeks.
Yeah, so start packing your Soldier of the Pantheons.
Your Shatter Assumptions.
Yeah. Well, I think that summarizes kind of all the angles for Niv-Mizzet. We really encourage people to check it out. There's a lot of room to sort of explore, to be creative, to play your pet cards if you like. We'll have a bunch of the deck lists that we talked about with some of the options you can play. And we'll catch everybody next week. Take it easy, guys.
Sounds good. See you later.
See you then.
That'll do it for episode 16 of the Faithless Brewing Podcast. You can find all the decks that we discussed on today's show, as well as links to our Niv-Mizzet video deck tech, in the episode description of your preferred podcast player. If you like what you heard today, have feedback for us, or just want to talk brews, we want to hear from you. You can follow us on Twitter at FaithlessMTG, email us faithlessbrewing@gmail.com, or find us on Reddit at r/modernmagic. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next week.